you know, fire its engines and push her engines to get away from the Atlas. But they don't need that for the cargo version. The cargo version is going to be folded up wings, cargo inside, and big fairing around it. A 5-meter fairing will break away, and they'll be off to the races. That's how Dream Chase is going to work. Dream Chase will also have a contract with the United Nations already right now for cargo stuff. The United Nations wants countries that can't afford the space program to collectively send the experiments up on future Dream Chaser cargo vehicles. So, also a long-term plan, if there's another space station that's built by, let's say, Bigelow, this thing will be carrying a crew up to the Bigelow station. If NASA extends their International Space Station beyond 2028, of course, they'll continue going up there and eventually bringing a crew. The question was, how many people can they bring up? It was designed to carry 7. But the usual number that will go up to the space station on any of our vehicles, our crewed vehicles, that would be Dream Chaser. That would be the crewed version of the Dragon. And the Starliner by Boeing will be 4 on each one. So that's the standard number, which is going to be good because instead of having a steady complement of 6 people on the International Space Station, you're going to have a permanent crew of 7. So that's their goal, and they should have that very shortly, because at the end of 2018, you're going to see the first launch of the crewed version of the Dragon, and that will be unmanned in the beginning for a test flight. Drop it. All that's going to do is go up to the space station, dock by itself, and I mean dock. It's not going to have use one of these robotic arms that the crewed version use. It's going to just dock with it automatically, completely autonomous system. Then it's going to stay up there for a period of time. It's going to undock all by itself. It's going to come back and land on runway 22, the 15,000-foot runway down in Florida. That's the initial plan. You should see that at the end of 2018. If that goes well. Correction. That was Dragon. Dragon's going to land in the Pacific Ocean. Dream Chaser will eventually land on a runway in Florida. The cargo version. And that's, by the way, all of these vehicles I'm talking about are reusable up to at least 10 times. So that's what we're heading for in the near future. Back to you, Dick. WS.
When I see the pictures of Dream Chaser docked with the International Space Station on its conception, the back end of Dream Chaser is docked. Dream Chaser looks like it doesn't have the conventional cargo board doors on the side like the space shuttle did. Looks like all of the cargo comes out of the back end. But you normally have a booster engine at the back end. So how do you dock with the back end toward the International Space Station to unload the cargo? And where does the rear engine go during that operation? Over to you, Paul, KQLIW.
The engines that Sierra Nevada Corporation developed are located to the left and right of center. Center, when you look at it, you see this cone-like thing. Well, that is the door. That's the gateway to get inside the Dream Chaser. And then that outside piece, I don't know if they're looking at that, the outside piece in the back, that's going to carry unpressurized cargo. So, and this thing also has the capability of not only berthing, but also docking. So if you go to either port, either the larger berthing port or the smaller docking port, so it's going to have that capability. So, not very happy about this one. I'm glad they got the contract. You know, when I came up a couple of years ago, 2014, and everybody thought, you know, that SpaceX was going to win with the Dragon extension on the cargo, you know, for the long, you know, the extension flight, and they figured, well, Boeing had a chance, you know. A lot of people pushing for Dream Chaser, but I didn't think the money was there. They all got contracts to do something. Boeing has a contract for a crew vehicle going up. They don't have a cargo version. SpaceX has both cargo version and crew version. And Dream Chaser for now has a cargo version, but you know they're going to have a crew version some years from now. Back to you, sir.
Okay, so the engines are left and right, and the real egress is by way of the center door for docking or berthing. If I tried to launch a piece of hardware, like the Hubble Space Telescope, I'm pretty sure that the berthing and docking door is not big enough for that, but a large diameter long piece of cargo, in theory, could be slipped out of the back end of the Dream Chaser, sort of like a great big sausage. Is that sort of true, Paul? WS2N, K2IW?
I think they're going to develop a cargo bay type of thing on that. I really do. I can see that coming. But I haven't seen that yet. And that would be for servicing satellites. The Trump administration has shown interest. Now we have a new administrator, Brandon Steen. I think that's his name. You know, he's also on board with this, from what I understand. They would like to use the Dream Chaser crewed version, so that's probably 5, 6, 7 years out. As long as the Hubble lasts that long, to go up to Hubble and use that for a servicing tool to keep the Hubble going. Wouldn't that be something?
So, did I understand you correctly? NASA has a new administrator named Brandon Steen, and when did that take place?
Yesterday or the day before. I hope I'm pronouncing his name right. I only read it a couple of times. He comes out of Oklahoma. You know, he's pro going to Mars, but I don't think there's going to be any change in NASA, the NASA program, from what I see. Time will tell. They do not have a deputy director yet. Deputy administrator. They usually have both. Fellow Light, what's his name? I forget his name. Light something or other. He's been acting director for the last 250 days or so. And now they finally got somebody. And yet he has to go through confirmation through the Senate and all, so probably a couple of weeks before he's the official administrator. Back to you, sir.
Okay, I'm trying to remember the other question I had along these lines. So you believe that Dream Chaser is going to get cargo bay doors very similar to the space shuttle, but right now you could slide a large diameter, long piece of cargo out that rear door. Any idea what diameter and what length of cargo you could move that way? Would it be half the diameter of the Hubble Space Telescope?
No way. No. Let's see. I don't know. Not the outside. You know, the berthing door, that's the big door. That's 53 inches, I think. The right number is 53 inches. And that's not... You know, that's not round, that's square. Roughly a square looking thing. 53 inches. So, the docking door is usually a little bit bigger than a meter. and that's usually illness. But people going in and out, small things that you can bring in and out. But the larger items, the science racks and things like that, you know, they really have to go through the birthing doors. So, no, you're not going to be able to carry another hover up there with you. But you're going to need some kind of capability to get out there, some kind of work platform. You've got to find a way to dock. I would imagine they could dock the way they're doing, the way they did with the shuttle. They could open, have the doors open up and have a docking column inside of that. And then they would have a work platform. I don't know, you know, I haven't seen any drawings or pictures of what this would look like. This is talking stage. And with this administration, you know, I have no idea what's going to happen in the future, but it's some kind of discussion that's taken place, that's all I can say. I read it on a couple of sites. I didn't read it on a NASA site, so we'll have to wait and see. That's many years down the road then.
Is there any discussion recently about a robot repair vehicle? A vehicle that can visit the individual satellites, repair and refuel, refurbish and whatever. Is there any conversation along those lines, Paul? Or is that so far not even being considered from all you can tell, K2RIW?
We had the Restore L mission. That was supposed to go up and do a Landsat mission. Landsat number 7. They wanted to work on that. Low Earth orbit. But I think that's running into some kind of funding problem temporarily. I thought that was going to go up next year, 2018, but I think they're going to wait on that. You know, a lot of money has been funded for the InSight mission. InSight was delayed back in 2 years ago, 2016, in March. It was supposed to go up to Mars. Going to drill holes into the planet 10 feet deep, put a seismometer in there, and a lot of money is going into making sure that that thing goes off, and that will be going up in May of the next year, 2018. So that's actually our next flight to Mars, the United States anyway. And there's other countries that are involved with their mission. India just had a failure. They have a PSLV rocket, a polar launch vehicle. That thing just sent a it was supposed to be semi-geosynchronous. I think it was going to be elliptical orbit. And it wasn't a communication, it was a navigation satellite. That's what it was. That went up last week or so, and the bearing doors didn't open. So, that's the end of that one. Back to you, Doug.
So, if I understand correctly, Restore L mission, that is a repair mission, which right now it's oriented toward repair and refurbishment, refueling. But are you saying that this is only a proposal, that it hasn't gotten funding, so therefore... That's the closest thing we've got to a repair robot. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that was the one that was being funded, and it looks like the funding has stopped, because I can't find any. It was supposed to go up like next year, spring of next year or something. Now I don't see anything on that, so my guess is that they're not making the news, or the funding is cut. You know, some of these websites they go to, they have missions planned, you know, a year or year and a half in advance, and rough ideas some of the flights that are going to go up, and that was one of them. Now I don't see it anymore. So, I don't know, maybe that was scratched. But I'm looking forward to the InSight mission. John, WG, not good. I was thinking of school. GWP. KTQ. I always thought it was a W. KTQ. WGB for like the inside mission. And I think we go to the seismometer that they want to put in the ground and all kinds of fancy equipment like that. Inside it stands for interior exploration using seismic investigation, geodesy, and heat transport. So it's a big long thing, but basically going to look for what the inside of Mars is made of. So I want to see that one. It's not a rover, but it's going to land, it's got an arm, it's going to put things on the surface. Something is going to drill 10 feet into the ground. That I got to see. Back.
That does sound ambitious. And I guess they're hoping to find water in certain areas of Mars 10 feet down. Is that the idea of a fall?
No, they're supposed to have some kind of, you know, let's call it a seismometer, earthquake detector of some sort, and that's going to go at the bottom of this 10-foot thing. And then they have this tank that's made out of titanium, I think it's like about the size of a football. And the French, Kness was making CNES, that's the French, group like NASA was developing this tank, and they had a leak in it. It has to be a perfect vacuum, and no matter what they did, they couldn't seal it. So that's what delayed it. It was supposed to go up in 2016, and they couldn't make the launch time, so they canceled that. And then JPL picked up on it, and they developed a better tank. Well, you know them; they're gonna get it done. And they got it done, everything works, but it's all set, ready to go in May of next year.
Okay, this is the Space Report. You're listening to Space Report number 666 of the series by Paul WS2N. Anybody within the sound of my voice have any further questions or comments on Space Report or anything else, all of the above, give me your call letters and name right now, K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay. Can you think of anything else we should cover, Paul? Or have we covered enough and is it time to rest a little early tonight? WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, whatever you want to do. I had the information about the RTGs. You know, we were talking about the plutonium-238. And the half-life was 87 years. In time, 87 years, and that we kind of knew, but then you were asking about the other one, plutonium-239, and I think that's some ridiculous amount of years, like, I lost it, I had it somewhere, it was 27,000 years, some ridiculous number, so that's not doable. So I did look that up. What we send up is good for 87 years. Whatever the new stuff they're developing, I don't know how long that's going to last. But there's only so much of the stuff that's plutonium-238.
Yeah, I remember looking up plutonium 236, 7, 8, 9, and so on. The next one that's very available is plutonium 239, I think it is. And the good news is it's got some very long half-life, like 24,000 years, 27,000 years. That's the good news. The bad news is it decays so slowly, it doesn't give you very much heat, is my guess. Something that's going to last that long means it's a very slow radioactive action. Whereas plutonium-238, a chunk of that sitting on the table, I think will glow red because it is that radioactive. I've seen pictures of it. It looks like it's a red pellet of the stuff. Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
Yeah, that's it. I think they take, like, it's 8 pounds or something, and they put it into these RTGs, and each one gives them 103, or I think it's 103 watts. So, some of the spacecraft like Voyager have three on board, so they can develop, you know, like 309 watts, although for some reason they say Voyager started out with more power than that. But, you know, it's a ballpark figure. And after 8 to 7 years, you know, you down to half the power. And another 8 to 7 years after that, you'll be down to 25%. But even if it lasted that long, I think the thermocouples will fail on Voyager. And that'll be it. You know, one day you're going to hear on the news that we lost contact with Voyager. I don't think it's going to be because of the half life. I think it's going to be a failure of these thermocouples.
It sounds like Voyager started off with something like 300 watts of raw electrical power capability, and they're now down to some small portion of that, where I think they're running nothing but the cosmic ray detector and the transmitter. I think it's the only things they're running at this time. It sounds like they're down to less than 100 watts of total output. Is that roughly true, Paul?
Yeah, but, you know, 10 times that amount, it goes off heat. So they have, like, heat tubes or ducting, you know, some type of ducting that goes to some of the equipment. So it does, you know, have that purpose. Yeah, you know, it's the dual purpose to keep things warm and supplies electricity. All these RTGs do. And, you know, we've had quite a few flights. I think there's some 20 flights that we've sent up and have these things. But because of the limited supply, you know, you can only put so many more flights up. I know the Rover 2020 will have it. And eventually another one that they plan on sending to Europa. Called the Europa Clipper, and that's going to have it, Jeff.
So right now, the total amount of plutonium-238 that's available is enough for, about 5 or 6 more radioactive thermal generators, and then you've used up all the fuel. And right now, no one has proposed doing anything to gather more plutonium-238. Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
Some years ago, John told us that they have a project in Oregon, I believe it was Oregon, and they're working on developing, not going to be, you know, plutonium-238, but some other product that does the same thing. And that's going to be very helpful. And they're also trying to develop better, you know, thermal couple type of system to, to remember, it's gonna, you know, be four times better than what they're doing now. So, you know, for whatever amount of heat they're getting now, let's say, you know, you're gonna get 100 watts out of it. You know, for the same amount of heat, you'll be able to get 400 watts. They are developing that setup, so you won't need as much. And whatever they're developing, I don't think they're getting that much of it. But whatever it is, if you have a system that is more efficient, that's going to be a lot better. You know, you can still send these deep space probes out with 400 or 500 watts system.
Is that possibly a more efficient thermocouple-like device, the pole? Is that where the extra efficiency is coming from?
Yes, they have a department somewhere that makes these things. Probably with the Defense Department, it sounds like something that they would do. Probably DARPA, and they're constantly using different materials and in different fashions and developing these things. And they said over the last 15 years or so, they've been able to come up with something better than whatever they're using. But I guess they have to test it for a long period of time to make sure you don't have a breakdown period, so they can't just rush out and put these things in. Or everything that's in space, radio equipment, computers, everything that goes up there is always 5 years behind development here on Earth. Back to you.
I'm doing an experiment here. I'm going to a low power output, and I'm going to try aiming my antenna. Okay, that's getting more noisy. Can I go in the other direction? Yeah, I had it at the right place. Now, you're producing a little bit of noise, Paul. Do you have the ability to aim your antenna a couple of degrees clockwise or a couple of degrees counterclockwise? Over to you, Paul. And tell me what you're doing when you're doing it.
Yeah, I can, but I went down to a lower power. That's, I don't want to cook the radio, so going back up, let's see. Back on high. Here we go. That should be better.
Go back to the low power, but now try a few degrees to the right, a few more degrees to the right, a few degrees to the left, a few more degrees to the left, and tell me what you're doing. I think we can peak you a little bit better. Go ahead.
Yeah. Right now I'm not getting a reading on my meter. Oh yes, there it is. There must be in some kind of intermittent thing there. Okay, I'm going toward the north a little bit. How's that?
Now that sounds a little bit better. Keep going in that direction and tell me what you're doing.
Rotating north. Yeah, still going north. And that's probably too far.
You're absolutely right. That went too far. Go back two-thirds of that distance.
Okay, going back. And that should be... That's about two-thirds, not about half. That should be it.
That's a good point. You can stay at low power. There's just a tiny bit of hiss and you sound good. Okay, one last call. Any further questions or comments with the space report or anything else, give me your call letters right now. K2RIW.
Okay.
I heard a very noisy signal. Want to try again?
KG2RY.
Okay. I think I heard KG2RY. Is it Kilo Golf 2 Romeo Yankee? If so, correct me and give me your name, sir. Go ahead.
QSL. Name is David. Let me make sure I don't have a loose connection. Hold on.
You sound good right now, David.
Okay, thank you, sir. Question. Do you folks dabble in any of the digital modes?
There are a good number of people on this repeater who do. I'm not one of them. I'm not sure if Paul is. Paul, do you dabble in any of the digital modes? I'll bet you you've used some of the WSJTs. WS2N, K2RIW.
I got as far as PSK31. Used to do AMTOR years ago in RITI, but that's it. I no longer have that capability. Back to you, Dick.
You got it, David.
So, I have Ham Radio Deluxe, and I connected my Fox Tango 891 to it, you know. You're talking about PSK. I'm interested in PSK and SSTV over the HF, and if anybody has any, like, helpful tips or hint information about it, I'd be very appreciative.
I know I did it quite a few years ago when it first came out, and outside of hooking it up to the computer, downloading the software, that was pretty much it. Got to watch the waterfall spectrum appear, you know, as it went by, and you were able to. I had a mouse on that computer. I don't know what I would do with this one. I have a Chromebook now. Probably wouldn't work. But, on the old, on that old gateway machine, I used to be able to move it back and forth and pick up the signals and start typing back and forth to them. It was very good. A lot of fun. And I tried it on one of the field days that Weimark had as well. SIG back to you. This is Annette, so we're going back to net control. KQRI WWS1.
KC2GS.
You've got it right.
Okay, I think we might have talked to David about this at one time. I don't remember. There's one very good program. It's called MMSSTV. Other programs actually use their module as the primary way of doing it. And if you look at websites, they'll give you a couple of frequencies that regulars just hang out on 40 and 40 was the most active when I played around with it. It's probably about five guys that I could pick up who were sending it all through the day and the night. They generated all kinds of interesting graphics. It was somewhat interesting. You don't meet a lot of different guys. You meet a couple of guys who are really into it.
You've got it, Joe. I mean, David.
Thank you, folks. You know, Roy, the Ham Radio Deluxe and some of these other CAT packages include, you know, some kind of generation of SSTV in the package. Still trying to figure it out. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, I have Ham Radio Deluxe. It's rather bulky and kludgy and slow, and I actually pay for it. But when I wanted to play with SSTV, I got, as I said, MMSSTV. It's free, and it's basically the module that everyone else seems to use anyway. And it runs fast, and I have no problems with it, and it's very self-explanatory. It's not that difficult. As long as you can figure out how to get your computer sound card hooked up to your radio, you're in like Flint.
Yes, it might require another cable. I might have to get a different cable. Thank you very much for the information. I have one more short question about DMR. The question is, how do you get clusters like networks to program into DMR? Go ahead.
Want me to take this, Dick?
Go right ahead.
Okay, there's no clusters of network with DMR. They're talk groups. They're called talk groups, and they have their own access code. So what you do is you set up IDs for those talk groups on your code plug, and it lets you communicate to those talk groups. You have to get the list of talk groups from someplace. Some people have websites that list them very nicely. Other guys are a little bit more paranoid, and you have to email them or call them up and ask them what talk groups are available. But there's a lot of really big talk groups. There's TAC 310, there's TAC 311, there's North America. There's a whole bunch of them. And the local LimeWire has their own talk group for local conversations across a number of DMR repeaters in the metropolitan area.
Okay, Jack. Go ahead, Eric.
You do a Google search for Bronx Turbo, that's TRBO.net. You'll find on that webpage all of the DMR repeaters that are listed and the talk groups that are available to them. And you can even find, if you do some looking, you can find some code plugs for various different radios that are already programmed. You don't have to make yourself crazy programming your radio.
Got it, David.
The radio came with 16 channels. I messed with a couple of them, but I kept most of them intact. I was able to upload into the software and then download from the software back into the radio. But I want to know, like, how do I program, let's say, you know, there's a talk group or even a repeater that I want to reach. You know, is there, like, any way that I could, sort of like Chirp, where, you know, you go into a repeater book and you download a file that has, you know, all the information in it. I could just put it right into the HT. Go ahead.
Well, what kind of a DMR radio do you have? Answer that question. I'll tell you what to do.
I have an MD380. Go ahead.
All right. And where are you located? And what repeaters are you interested in?
Lower Manhattan. And I'm interested, like, 20 miles, maybe 10 or 15 mile proximity.
Right. So the MD-380 is actually some newer software that comes from not the the manufacturer, but some guys that wrote it, and just about everybody's using it. That radio is capable of maintaining the entire DMR database, user database in it. But go to bronxturbo.net, and you will find code plugs that are already set up for most of the repeaters in the area. By the way, even though it's only 16 channels, that's 16 channels per zone, you can have 100 zones, so you're not limited to 16 channels or 16 repeaters. I think the way I have mine set up, I've got something like 30 zones at the analog repeaters in them. I have the repeaters for New York City, I have the repeaters for out here. And even if you go to the Limewalk.org, you'll find some code plugs for it. And in the Yahoo groups, you'll find an awful lot of code plugs that are already put together. If you're a first-time user, you're going to find the software a little bit weird, and it may be difficult in the beginning to do your own programming. It's much easier to use someone else's.
USL, thank you very, very much. The word code plug, that was the word I was looking for. Thank you very much. KG2RY, back to net control.
Sounds like we have no further discussions on that subject, and maybe no further discussions on any other. I'll stand by one more time. If nobody has any further questions or comments, we're going to close down for tonight. K2RIW listening.
Yeah, just a quick question, Jake, but I'm tongue twisted. How does the audio on this radio sound?
I meant to tell you, you're perfect. Great audio on that one. David was a little bit heavy. He should back off 1 dB, but you've got it set just right. One of your radios is quite low, and you've got to shout into the mic. You got this one just right, Eric.
Yeah, always is a broadcast mic on this radio. Now, the other radio is a noise canceler, and I never seem to get it quite right. Either you put it in the right place, it's got good audio, you're slightly off to one side or above or below, and everything's low.
And to NBR. NBR, go ahead. Start up with your name.
Okay, Dick. Hell, here is John. QTH is Northern Westchester County. I was when you were talking about Venus before. Do you know what the does anybody know what the strategy is for beating that 900 degree heat? You know, so they can stay online a little longer.
I think the Soviets landed a craft on Venus that only transmitted for a fraction of an hour. I think they have some kind of material that boils off to keep the electronics cool. But to make electronics, battery operated, for instance, that can operate at 850-900 degrees Fahrenheit, I don't know if that's possible. Anybody got any further words on that?
WS1.
You got a poll?
This is just a proposal that Jet Propulsion Laboratory is doing. They have designs, they sort of pictures, and it looks like a cathedral. It's like a bunch of steel and, you know, and welded together. Put a fan in the middle. The wind on the planet will rotate the fan and make mechanical things happen. We'll rotate another gear for another fan on top to move that will. We'll have blades on it, and then those blades will be reflective. With a satellite in space, sending radar through the clouds, hitting this, pinging this thing that's on the surface. Depending on how that's spinning, the way the blades are fashioned or whatever, we'll be able to send information back to the satellite. So, I mean, this is the first time I read this, but it's also going to have the capability, because of the wind, this is going to be a mechanized thing that's going to be able to make this thing move on the surface. So, officially, it would be a rover. But, they have a long way to go. That's the idea. In other words, no real electronics or whatever electronics they do have on board, if anything's wise, it's going to be like in titanium or something where it's not going to melt. Back to you, Dick.
To operate field effect transistors, bipolar transistors, or whatever. And there's been a proposal from time to time to make transistors out of diamond. I think you could make transistors out of diamond that can tolerate very high temperatures. But germanium, silicon, I don't think so. Ceramic tubes could survive those temperatures. And you're almost at the temperature where you wouldn't have to apply filament power. Just the heat of the environment will give you a filament operation. And you have the right coating material so that the filament does the emitting and the plate doesn't. So you could operate ceramic tubes, maybe diamond transistors. But now to talk to a spacecraft on the surface mechanically, that strikes me as a rough way to go. You're not going to get very good information rate. But real electronics by way of ceramic tubes, I think it could be done in that pole. But when the Russians did it, I think they had some kind of a wax that boiled off to keep it cool for the period of time that, like for a fraction of an hour, it made some measurements of the surface and did give you a picture. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, they had some kind of robotic arm or something to it. I remember that. The Varina landed. They did like a half a dozen of these things. So. But, they didn't last long. But the idea here is to keep all the electronics in space, send the radar down to get the information that way. And what are they going to tell them? The wind speed, maybe the cloud cover, you know, how much... I can't imagine what they're going to tell them. Their location. It's interesting, but, you know, this could be decades away from what I see, but it's an interesting thought. Have this just mechanical thing moving around all by itself with the wind and no real electronics. Everything up in space. Wow. Back to you, Dick. Just had one quick comment about an antenna. I wonder if you saw the article. Let me drop it. It was QST September, page 61, all about the dipole feed points, different points that you could feed the dipole. You can get different bands. That was a pretty good article. So, I don't know if you haven't read it, page 61, go back either.
The Carolina Windham antenna is fed 63% off to one side, as I remember. And it does give you multiple band operation with the right kind of a balance. Was this thing at all like that, Paul? I'm having trouble remembering it. Go ahead.
Yeah, it starts up, you know, the basics with the feed point in the middle, and they move to a different location. They get to one point that they're able to operate three different bands at one time on the same dipole. Just by Ward Silver, you know, N0AX, right below a lot of this stuff. But I'm trying to think. I have it right here. It's 5. I can't see. I'm on the line. 1/6 off the one side. You get apparently three bands or something. It leads up to that. You know, what would happen if you move it, you know, 1/3? And then what would happen if it was 1/6? You know, they're both using 4-to-1 transformers to do the job. But in the long run, he's able to get three bands back.
So this is essentially a long wire or a dipole-like thing at the lowest band. And by feeding it off to one side with the right kind of a balance, he can make it operate a reasonable standing wave ratio on two more bands. And is that an easier way to go than the fan dipole? I don't know. Is that an easier way to go with the... It's easier than an ordinary dipole, because an ordinary dipole, the second harmonic band is very hard to feed. So I can see some advantage of that. Would you want to build one of those, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I'm dipole happy, you know, so I have a G5RB up and an 80-meter half-wave dipole. And I've used different dipoles over the years. But this one would do 40, 20, and 10. If the bands ever come back to life, it would be fun back here.
In the case of Venus, not only is it ridiculously hot at the surface, numbers like 800, like 850 degrees Fahrenheit, essentially melting lead temperature. You've got high winds, you've got a somewhat sulfuric atmosphere, and you've got 150 atmospheres of pressure. So that atmosphere is so thick and dense, it's one continuous great big cloud, and there's 150 atmospheres. I believe you get a whole lot of optical curvature of the atmosphere. If you try to look at something a mile away, I think you'd be looking at a very great big curved path, if you know what I mean, because the atmosphere closer to the ground has a higher refractive index than the atmosphere a few number of feet above the ground. I think you remember that this 150 atmosphere pressure gives you some very weird effects along those lines. So that's a ring a bell, Paul, WS2N, K2IW.
Most of the articles I've read about that is 90 bar, including this one, so I guess that's the general consensus. But so, one bar is one atmosphere for us, which is, what, 14.7 pounds. So, multiply that times 90, look at the pressure you got, 150. That would be 1,400 some odd pounds, of course, PSI. Not much is going to survive with that, especially with the 900 degrees.
90 barometric pressure at 14.7 as a reference is 1,323 pounds, 1,323 pounds per square inch. Even if you've got a spacesuit that's got ridiculously good insulation where you can tolerate the temperature, can you imagine building a spacesuit that can tolerate that pressure? It's the exact reverse. Right now, to build a spacesuit that holds the pressure inside for an astronaut is reasonably difficult. Can you imagine building an inside-out spacesuit that can take 1,323 pounds on the outside without crushing the astronaut? Wow. Oh, you pulled K2LIW. There's an engineering challenge for you.
Yeah, let's see. I think that would be, what is it? For every 32, I think it's every 30 feet you go down, it's the equivalent of another atmosphere in water, something like that. Wow. I'm trying to think. What's the deepest you can go in a deep diving suit? What's the lowest they've gone in that? These big metal contraptions that you're in, holding back the pressure. I forget what the record is on that, but I wonder if that's higher than the 90 bars. But that would be what, 39 degrees temperature, not 900 degrees.
Water is 62.4 pounds per cubic foot. Therefore, each foot that you get down, you get 0.43 pounds per square inch increase. So 1,323 pounds divided by 0.43, you go down 3,000 feet in water, and you'll get that pressure pull. So that's the pressure you get on the Earth when you go down 3,000 feet down in water. And the deepest part of the ocean is something like 31,000 feet down. So 3,000 feet was what? Not even 1 mile down, Paul. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. So, well, we've done it with the bathysphere. We could do the pressure. We just can't do the heat and the combination of the heat and the pressure. Yeah, we used to say every foot up was a half a pound of pressure. We used to estimate it that way. So you look at a building, and if you were 20 floors high, you'd be up to 10 psi. So we used to do ballpark figures, half a pound per foot.
Something's wrong here, Paul. Half a pound per foot when you go up in a building. Are you discussing air pressure? That doesn't sound right.
Water pressure.
Okay, now I see what you're saying. The pipes in the building. Alrighty. It's essentially midnight. 73, you all. Be kind to each other. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye for now. K2LIW clear. Over to you, Paul.
We'll be here next week, hopefully. And I guess keep your batteries charged. Watch the news. Hopefully this other hurricane doesn't start coming this way. But we'll be discussing that, I guess, on Sunday. If it's getting close, it would be, what, probably Monday if it came to the East Coast. We don't need that. 73, have a good day. And anybody want to pick it up? You got it. The last minute or so. This is WS20.
Net tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL Amateur Radio Repeater System.
Alpha Juliet from WB2BXO in Philadelphia via Echo Link.
WB2BXO in Philadelphia via Echo Link. This is W1GAJ. We're in Long Branch, New Jersey. We're at a hotel. We're on the balcony. We're about six stories up, so it's probably about close to 100 feet, and we're just using the handy talkie names. David, over.
Okay, you're still quieting into the repeater on Long Island. You probably have a fairly short line of sight path as a crow flies. You're actually probably closer to me than the repeater. I don't know if the repeater's going to stay up. I think this repeater shuts down at 12 or 12 o'clock or thereabouts on Sunday nights. My name is Frank, by the way. I'm actually in Northeast Philadelphia. I'm getting into the repeater via Echo Link. I was just listening to TechNet.
12:04 a.m. 73 and good night from the W2VL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30 W2VL repeater system. W2VL repeater.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, code number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Thank you.
at 8:30. This is the W2VL Amateur Radio Repeater System.
Thank you.